From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Federal housing officials are considering a change in Section 8 vouchers that would let voucher holders in some cities move to more affluent suburbs. We talk about the implications with an assistant secretary at HUD. Then today, she's a Grammy-nominated jazz and soul singer. But before any of that, international chanteuse Mesa got her start in the Morgan State University choir. Plus, an incorrigible ghost materializes in Everyman Theater's production of Blithe Spirit that feels happily haunted by the spirit of comic playwright Noel Coward. Jaywin Russick brings us her review. And the French tall ship Hermione sails into Annapolis Harbor tomorrow to great fanfare. We learn the Revolutionary War history of the ship, the Marquis de Lafayette, and the French soldiers buried at St. John's. Now news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Like cities across the country, Baltimore for decades concentrated subsidized housing into areas that became racially segregated, even if they hadn't started out that way. Lawsuits have been filed. Housing mobility programs have been started. The segregation remains. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, is now considering a change that would allow more flexibility in where people who hold public housing vouchers can live. Voucher holders now concentrated in the city could move to the suburbs. With us on the line from HUD to talk about it is Kathy O'Regan, Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at HUD. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. I'm glad to be here.
Give me the basics of how the Housing Choice Voucher Program, also known as Section 8, how it works right now.
So it was good to hear that background of the history of how we have ended up with one contributing force on segregated neighborhoods. And some of it is blamed on place-based housing strategies in the past. And so in the 1970s, we moved to putting an emphasis on demand-based. So the idea is that you give a voucher to a household, and they take it with them to the housing unit of their choice in the private market so that they have much more flexibility on where they live when they access assisted housing. And that's what a voucher does. The way that they operate with the voucher is that we set rent payment standards. And you can't go and just rent any old apartment at any old price. We actually set a maximum rent that you can use if you have one of these vouchers. And right now, the maximum rent is set metropolitan-wide. We call these fair market rents, but I'll keep calling them maximum rents. And it turns out that one of the issues with metropolitan-wide rent standards are that you may end up with a rent standard that primarily gives you opportunities to live in high poverty neighborhoods, but that don't quite have enough high enough rent to get you into a low poverty neighborhood.
So how the change that HUD is considering?
So right now we pay the same rent, maximum rent, no matter where you live in the city of Baltimore, the suburbs, anywhere in Washington, D.C. It's within one rent standard for that entire metro area. And so one of the things that can be true in areas in which there's a lot of variability in rent that varies by quality of neighborhood is that the metro FMR, that rent standard, is not high enough to get into a low poverty neighborhood. So the approach that we're proposing and that we're gathering comments on right now is to move down to a smaller level of geography, to think about neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods here are going to be at the zip code level. So that if you're trying to get into a zip code that has low poverty and somewhat higher rents, the maximum rent we're willing to pay from HUD is higher than another neighborhood that has much lower rents.
Well, if HUD's going to be subsidizing higher rents in the suburbs, how much more might this system cost than the current one?
Right. That would be a big concern because right now there are long wait lists for these vouchers, and we actually only cover about 25% of the households that are eligible. So anything we do to increase costs comes at a big opportunity cost of some other family that needs the subsidy. And so that would be a concern, and we have this new research that's taken a look at Dallas, Texas, where in fact these lower zip code level rents have been in operation for several years, and found that, in fact, when we moved to zip code level maximum rents, families were more successful on getting to lower poverty and particularly lower crime neighborhoods, which is critical for the development of children. But they did this, on average, at the same cost. So the average costs per voucher paid by the Dallas public housing authorities stayed the same over this time. Because what you're doing is you're increasing some payments in higher opportunity neighborhoods, and you're lowering them a bit in some of these other neighborhoods where, in fact, the rents are lower, so you don't need the maximum rent to be quite as high.
I want to bring this issue to Baltimore. Baltimore already has the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program. It was created out of a lawsuit, Thompson v. HUD, that challenged the segregation of African Americans in public housing in impoverished areas in the city. The mobility program lets those in the Housing Choice Voucher Program move to the suburbs. In 2012, as part of our series, The Lines Between Us, we spoke with Nicole, who asked us not to use her last name. She took part in the program. She moved from Baltimore to Columbia.
It took a while to get used to being out here, because trying to get a job was, like, very difficult. When I moved, at the time, my contract ended at the last job, so I was on unemployment when I moved here. So I kind of just was going to school. But now that I'm really settled in, I'm working in Columbia, I transferred colleges out in Columbia, I'm just happy that, you know, I'm in this program, because it's helping me to build myself up.
How would this change we're talking about, this proposed change, build on the housing mobility program?
So the mobility program is a subpart of what is done in vouchers in Baltimore. So the benefit of moving to zip code level rent payments are those vouchers that are not in the mobility program would be more likely to open up opportunities such as the opportunity that Nicole had.
That's Kathy O'Regan, Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at HUD. Here on 88.1 Maryland Morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a change the federal department is considering in the way it calculates rent subsidies for public housing. The Baltimore Sun spoke with Baltimore City Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano last week about this idea. He said, quote, "We're going to look at it a lot more closely, but the preliminary signs are that it would really dramatically undermine what we're doing and severely limit people's housing choice and reduce the quality of the housing they would end up with," close quote. One of his concerns is that it could reduce demand for subsidized housing in the city, which means less investment in low-income housing. Is Commissioner Graziano right to be worried?
So I want to unbundle some of the things he said and think about the way in which you might get different impacts. And I'm going to start with the voucher holders. So one of the concerns he was saying is you might end up in lower quality units. So we have, you know, after we make a change in this policy, there'll be some voucher households who want to take advantage of the change in rent payment standards and move elsewhere. And the evidence we have from Dallas is that, in fact, the average quality of units experienced by voucher holders after the change went up. So on average, you would expect this to improve the quality of units that voucher holders get access to.
Can I interrupt you right there to try to understand that? Because as you said a few minutes ago, you'd expect higher payments in more affluent neighborhoods with landlords accepting these vouchers, lower payments in poor neighborhoods. So it would make sense to me that the quality of housing in poor neighborhoods, there would be less investment. It would go down. How did it not work that way in Dallas?
So you've kind of got two different type of experiences going on, right? The voucher holders who move to better neighborhoods, and I think we can all, from Nicole's story and logic, figure out how good that plays out. But what about the voucher holders who stay in the neighborhood they're in and they don't want to move? So it turns out that one of the things that happens with the current policy, and the current policy we have in these metropolitan areas that have very concentrated voucher holders, so the policy change we're proposing is not nationwide. What we're trying to do is go to places where we have a particular problem. So in those places, we currently have a policy of just increasing our rent payment standards across the board in the entire metropolitan area. And what has happened is, and what the research shows is, that leads to just rents going up rather than the housing getting better in those neighborhoods. And so what can happen in these other neighborhoods as we lower the rent payments over time, this would be phased in, is in fact We would expect the rents to go down a bit, but you shouldn't necessarily expect any of the quality of the housing to go down. So I want to also emphasize that we're not talking about changing rent payment standards for any of the other many HUD programs that are actually focused on driving investment in these types of neighborhoods. That's not what we're focusing on. We're carving out strictly these tenant-based vouchers, which are not, even in concentrated neighborhoods, are not a big funding stream. So we would expect over time maybe the rents to go down a little bit in the neighborhood, but not the quality of the stock.
I interrupted you. You said you wanted to unbundle some of the other points that Commissioner Graziano made.
Right. So this is one piece that you might worry about is, and you should worry about, is the effect on the voucher holders. And then the second piece is thinking about what else it might mean in the neighborhood. And that's when you think about that funding stream. So even in neighborhoods that have a high concentration of voucher households, they don't make up the majority of voucher holders, of tenants in the neighborhood at all. And so they are not the major stream for investment. And the fact that we're not currently thinking about any of these other programs of funding streams being affected by this is what I mean by that second part. So it's not as though our voucher payments are a large share of the rental payments going into the housing stock in these neighborhoods.
In the suburbs, Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz has expressed optimism and says that this might turn out to be good for Baltimore County and for the region. But some other elected officials are not at all optimistic. Delegate Patrick McDonough, a Republican who represents Baltimore and Harford counties, told The Sun that he intends to fight this change. Quote, "This is nothing more than a big push to try to spread government-subsidized rentals in all areas of the county. I'll fight it in any way I can," close quote. What would you say to him?
This is purely about providing households with some choice. There is nothing mandated here. No one's going to be required to move. We simply see that in some metropolitan areas, the way we currently operate our voucher program does not provide families with opportunity and choice to go to low poverty neighborhoods. Any neighborhood that voucher holders are moving to, if these are higher rent neighborhoods, they will be a very, very small change. You will not notice it in the neighborhood. This is not some large amount of influx. It's about a little bit more opportunity for these families. There's no mandate here for them going to the suburbs. There's nothing along those lines. We're simply proposing a change in the rent standards that we do to open up a few more neighborhoods.
Thank you. I appreciate your walking us through it.
Not at all.
Kathy O'Regan is Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at HUD. HUD is taking public comments on the voucher shift now. The proposed change, if adopted by HUD, would not take effect for at least a year and a half. We've got more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, R&B, jazz, and soul singer Mesa. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Morning, everybody. Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. On Thursday night, the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture will celebrate its 10th anniversary with a concert by the internationally acclaimed jazz, soul, and R&B singer Mesa. Mesa grew up here in Baltimore, and she still calls Baltimore home. She studied classical singing at Morgan State University, and she has toured the world with the likes of Stevie Wonder and the British jazz-funk band Incognito. 20 years ago, she released her first solo album, and last month, she released a new album to mark that milestone. Here's the title cut. It's called Back to Love.
When we first met, I was guarded and unsure. The hurt from my past made me close every open door. It's becoming so clear, you're the one that I adore. It's the way you love me, baby. You're the one I've been waiting for.
Mesa joins me in the studio. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
It is so great to meet you.
Thank you, sweetheart.
And I got to tell you, I love this record.
Oh, thank
it
you.
It is terrific. Now, your last album, Blue Velvet Soul, got you a Grammy nomination.
Yeah, my first one.
Yeah, for Best R&B Traditional Performance.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really delights me about this record is the range of it.
Oh, that's good.
You know, so you got the Grammy nomination for R&B, but there's soul, there's jazz, there's dance music on this. I mean, the range is huge. I mean, is there a particular place that you know, describes your vibe the best?
Not really. I think my degree is in classical performance or vocal performance, and I've kind of pride myself in being able to sing anything. That's what I was taught. Being on the Morgan State University choir, we went from classical to gospel, R&B, jazz. We did it all. So it's kind of inside of me what I learned back then at Morgan, and it's still with me today.
Yeah, you were there with the great legendary Dr.
Yes,
Nathan Carter.
Absolutely.
Who was just
Uncle
such a
Nate.
Gift. Yeah, he was such a treasure in this town.
Yeah.
And the concerts, the Morgan Choir concerts in those days and still today under the direction of Eric Conway are a huge mix of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But that's where you
That's where I cut my teeth. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. There's a tune on this album called Keep It Moving.
I grabbed your lines, been hanging all this time, 'cause I want to believe all the things you said to me. But less words, more deeds, this is what I like to see. Yeah, I hear you talk.
And this one, I wonder if this is something of a stylistic departure from what you have done, you know, in these other records over the last 20 years. This is kind of a new thing.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, when I asked Stokely to join me on this record, I asked him for a really funky, up-tempo, throwback and modern vibe. And he gave me all of it in one song. And it's really great. You know, I mean, he's just such a great singer-songwriter. And it was
so tell us about Stokely.
He's just awesome. Just a beautiful person. I mean, he's been the lead singer and drummer, been conditioned for a long time. And he's just a beautiful soul. It's, you know, in this industry, it's so rare to meet genuine people. And it was very nice to meet somebody like him.
Mm-hmm. And you met a bunch of different folks for this record. I mean, you collaborated with all sorts of
Yeah, Phil
people.
Perry was, he's one of the best, one of the greatest iconic falsettos in the country. And I think in this world, basically. But he's not, I don't think he's known as enough for that. He's very popular in certain scenes, in certain areas of music, but I just think that he definitely could have been an opera singer, I believe.
Yeah, and so could you. Right? Yeah. Did you, I mean, did you ever try that?
I did. I thought about it for like a split second, but I just know jazz music and soul and R&B have been calling me since I was a kid, so I knew that's really where I wanted to go. But thank God for that classical training, because it's really sustained me for the last 25 years.
I mean, it really helps to have a good, solid vocal technique.
Absolutely.
Because if you're working all the time, as you do, I mean, you're traveling, you're singing.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're traveling and singing in the same day.
That in the same day,
that
and
can
it's really
wreck
rough.
A voice
yeah.
if you don't produce it correctly.
Right,
you
absolutely.
Got to have the chops, the technique to
produce and it. Yeah, and people don't understand how important that is, because we're such in a world where everything's instantaneous, fame and all that kind of stuff, but people are reaching for it. They don't understand how to hone your craft and be an artist. That's really what it's about, and it's really important. So the training is very important.
Here's a tune called Heavenly Voices from the new album Back to Love. So this is a jazz piece, but it's kind of inspired by spirituals.
Yeah,
did you sing
it
a lot in church, too, in addition to Morgan?
No, I didn't. Not a lot at all. I didn't really, wasn't raised in the church. My parents raised me with this kind of spiritual background. And we believe in God, and we believe in love and all that kind of stuff. And so I wasn't a churchgoer, but it's just that to me, I just, you know, love is everything to me. And it's always been that way since I was a kid. I lead with love throughout my whole life. And so I really want to help people. I want people to be inspired by that and understand that it's not, everything's not so negative all the time.
And, of course, you know, you did sing a spiritual or two or 2000.
I did.
When you were at Morgan.
I sure
right?
did. Absolutely.
So, you know, you're steeped in that style, but then, you know, you make it your own.
Right.
You know, and tell us about your work with Stevie Wonder.
I mean, that was
fantastic. He is kind of a mentor to you, hasn't he?
He is. When I was in my last year at Morgan, he came to sing with the choir, and my best friend was singing with him already, and I auditioned. I passed the audition, but I wasn't finished Morgan yet, so I asked him, could I come out the next year? And as soon as I graduated, I called him. And he was like, yeah, come on, I'm working on Jungle Fever Project. And you can sing background on that. It was amazing.
Yeah, and you toured with him?
Mm-hmm. We did a tour of all the, with Spike Lee, when we were doing the, you know, soundtrack tour, kind of movie tour.
Yeah, yeah. So you spent a good bit of time with
him. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was about a year. And then for my album, Motions of Love, he wrote a song called Have Sweet Dreams, which is beautiful. And he allowed me to sing it. I was in the studio when he just came to him. He wrote it. I watched him write that song, which was amazing.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. My guest this morning is Mesa. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about the release of her new CD. Just came out last month. It's called Back to Love. So you have a tune here on the album called Last Chance for Love, mm-hmm. Speaking of love. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a 70s mm-hmm. soul ballad.
Yeah.
Here's a little bit of Last Chance for Love.
Hush, baby, please, not another word. I understand. Everything I've heard, and I've lived life too. Yes, it's true.
So talk about the production process. I'm really, really impressed with the production values of this album.
Oh, wow.
No two tunes sound alike.
Oh, that's good.
And, you know, it's a really interesting instrumental treatments and vocal mm-hmm. treatments. Mm-hmm. How do you choose them? What's that collaborative process when you're working with? Because you work with different people on different tunes.
Right. So my main producer, Chris Big Dog Davis, the way we work together is either I come to him and I sing the parts to the song, like the music. Like the instruments, I'll sing drums, I'll sing bass parts, I'll sing that kind of thing. And then he'll take it and he'll come back like a week later and he'll have the whole song kind of spread out and written out. And sometimes I choose songs. People send me music and I can choose the music that I like. And then if I'm inspired by that, then I can write to that music. Like for instance, J.R. Hudson, who works a lot with Jill Scott, he sent me the songs Smiling and Miracle. And when I heard Smiling, he sent me the music. It was no lyrics to it, but the first word I saw in my mind was Smiling. And so that's how that came to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a different process, maybe a little bit for each song.
Oh, yeah.
But overarching, I mean, you start by picking them, figuring mm-hmm. out what you have in mind, and mm-hmm. then you just negotiate with the
right.
various producers about
right.
what they got in mind.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a tune that you have on this album I also really love a lot. It's called Tear It Up. Tear it down. So this one not only is an indication of the great production values, mm-hmm. but as you were speaking before, this also is all about spiritual values.
Yeah,
more you say, what you're going to do when the world comes to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you going to be ready or are you going to be still BSing? Which one is it going to be, you know? And I had to say that it really is speaking to myself. And it started out because I'm just trying to get my weight off. And I'm doing things like anything with music or taking care of my son, I'm like there 1,000,000% and I'm on it. But when it comes to that, I tend to lack something. I don't know what it is where I can't seem to get that done. So I was kind of writing the song to myself, and then it became a more spiritual thing. Let me spread this out. I see this song, and I hear it, and I'm praying so hard that the Olympics get this song. Because it sounds like an athlete's kind of inspirational song, and I really hope that it really works out to that, something near that.
Yeah, this is a 20-year anniversary of your first solo album.
Mm-hmm.
16 of those years are years you've had with your son. Does this
right.
represent a new chapter, some new possibilities as to what you can do professionally?
At this point, for a little while, these last 4 years or so, it's been a little bit hard to go on the road and leave him. But now he's getting older, and he's going to go to college. So I'll be a little more free to do things I need to do and not be worried about my son so much. But I mean, I'm always going to worry. I'm a worry mom, but you know, that kind of thing. But he's getting older and he wants to be a musician also. So, you know, we're going to see what happens with that.
Great. What's his name?
His name is Jazz.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jazz.
Yeah,
there you
Jazz
go.
Akuru. Yeah.
There you go. You know, so you're this little girl. Mm-hmm. You write about this on your website. And your mom takes you to see a production of Pearly, great Broadway show. And you say to yourself, that's what I want to do. I want to be on that stage singing.
Yeah.
But you're, and I bet there are folks listening to us right now. They're students in high school.
Oh, yeah.
They're students in college. They're at Morgan. They're at Towson. They're at UMBC. They're in, you know, University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And they're saying, I want to do that too.
Right.
So your dream did come true. You do this for a living.
Yes.
And you've done really well. You do it internationally.
Thank you.
What's your advice for those young kids who are listening to you who want to be you?
Wow. My biggest advice is to hone your craft and be an artist first. And not worry about any kind of fame and glory and all that kind of stuff. The idea is to make music to help people through their lives. That's what the whole point of this of music is. That's what the whole point of, I think it should be. I think you should get people around you who are of like mind, who have a specific goal and who have a positive way to make that goal happen. Try to stay away from negative people. Get a really good attorney. And I think you'll be okay.
A good attorney.
A good attorney.
And positive people.
Yes.
There you go. That's good advice for the music business. Well, it's been a delight talking to
Thank you, sweetheart. Thank
you
so much.
You know, good luck with the record. It sounds
thank
terrific.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much.
Mesa will be appearing in concert Thursday night in a performance to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture. Show starts at 7, and on Saturday at the Lewis Museum, the Dance Theater of Harlem will present a special performance in conjunction with the museum's current exhibition, Dance Theater of Harlem, 40 Years of Firsts. That performance begins Saturday at 8 o'clock, and the exhibition about the Dance Theater of Harlem will be at the Lewis until the end of August. We've got all the details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Monday morning here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. That means it's time to check in with theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Judy's up next. Stay with us.
I can't believe, baby.
The Everyman Theater in Baltimore is concluding its current season with Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit. Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has gone to see it, and she's brought us this review.
It's partly the filmy, flowing costume and partly the pallor of the makeup. But mostly, it's the way actress Beth Hylton floats, and occasionally skips, across Everyman Theater stage. Not to mention the way she emits bursts of tiny, naughty giggles, or the way she pouts when she doesn't get her way. All of these things make Hylton's portrayal of the late Elvira Condamine a delightfully incorrigible ghost. That's exactly what's called for in Noel Coward's 1941 comedy, Blithe Spirit. Elvira is the deceased first wife of a writer named Charles Condamine, played here by a rather high-strung Bruce Randolph Nelson. As research for a novel about a medium, Charles invites his neighbor, Madame Arcati, to conduct a séance at his home. What he gets is far more than research. Elvira herself materializes, but she can only be seen by Charles, definitely not by his second wife, Ruth, played by Megan Anderson as increasingly exasperated.
You must be able to see her. She's there. Look! Right in front of you. There!
I'm not mad. What's happened to you?
You can't see her.
Oh, this is a joke, dear. It's gone quite far enough. Now just sit down, will you, and stop being so idiotic?
What am I to do? What the hell am I to do?
I think you might at least be a little more pleased to see me.
Even when one of his wives is a ghost, Charles finds himself in the middle of a maelstrom of jealousy. This is all the funnier because the two wives couldn't be more different. Those differences are well delineated by actresses Anderson and Hylton under Vincent M. Lancisi's direction. Anderson's Ruth is sensible, even staid. Hylton's Elvira is wild and fun-loving. Their timing, when they're both with Charles, is comic precision. When Charles insults Elvira, Ruth invariably thinks his barbs are aimed at her. None of this would work, however, without a Madame Arcati who is deadly, pardon the pun, serious about her profession. Yes, she's got to be a bit of a kook, but it is essential that she believe in her work, a sense of conviction that actress Nancy Robinette pulls off with aplomb.
Oh, forgive this formality, but I shall have to make a report to the psychical research people.
Well, I would be very much obliged if there were no names mentioned.
Oh, the report will be confidential.
This is a small village, you know, and gossip would be most undesirable.
I quite understand. You say that she is visible only to your husband?
Yes.
Visible only to husband. Audible too, I presume?
Extremely audible.
Nancy Robinette also brings a wonderful spark of joy to her portrayal of Madame Arcadi. She's a medium who takes immense pleasure in her work. Designer Daniel Ettinger has created an elegant drawing room set with some amusing special effects by Lewis Shaw. And David Burdick's costumes, which for some reason have a 1920s flair, are debonair and chic. Noel Coward wrote Blithe Spirit in the midst of World War II. When he and the British people not only welcomed comic relief, but also the notion that the dead are in some way always with us. Everyman's production comes at a welcome time in Baltimore, too.
When did she pass over?
7 years ago.
Oh! That means she must have been on the waiting list.
The waiting list?
Yes. Otherwise, she would have got beyond the materialization stage by now. She must have marked herself down for a return visit.
John Lahr writes in his biography, Coward the Playwright, "A writer's work is his ghost, and Coward took solace in the belief that his spirit would haunt the world long after his body had departed it." I am a diehard Noel Coward fan. I've been to his home and his grave in Jamaica. You can certainly feel his spirit there. And though Everyman Theater's production is at times a little overwrought, it's happily haunted by the spirit of Noel Coward.
Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit is at the Everyman Theater in the Bromo Tower Arts and Entertainment District in Baltimore for a couple more weeks. It closes on June 28th. We've got all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. After a break for news, there's lots more ahead on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Annapolis will see a grand sight tomorrow, sailing into its harbor, the tall ship Hermione, the precise replica of the three-masted frigate that carried the Marquis de Lafayette back to America in 1780 with secret news that would prove crucial in America's fight for independence. There'll be ceremonies, a fife and drum parade, and a wreath laying. And joining us to put tomorrow's events in context is architect and amateur historian Peter Schwab. He's past president of the Society of the Sons of the Revolution in the state of Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Sheila.
So let's talk first about the part of Annapolis history connected to the original frigate Hermione. What news was the young Marquis de Lafayette carrying for his mentor George Washington when he arrived on the Hermione in April of 1780?
He brought news from Louis XVI of his support, which was a risky thing to do at the time, and it meant a lot of money, but his support for the American cause. By doing that, he was entering into a world war, and it was important, things like the Sugar Islands. We're talking the equivalent of modern multi-billion-dollar corporations. Those were the things that were at stake. But in our case, it was in order to help our effort in our struggle against the British Army.
And it was to Annapolis that the frigate Hermione?
The Hermione returned to New England and brought Lafayette back with that news. Soon after, it became apparent when the French did arrive that what they really brought, they brought soldiers, but they brought ships. The ship is the more powerful thing. If you're able to block a port, then that's like a big chess game. And so in order to catch Cornwallis at Yorktown, they sent their army marching south from Massachusetts and through Newport, Rhode Island. The American army was traveling a parallel course, but the French arrived in Annapolis in the summer of 1781, extremely hot August weather, traveling in woolen coats and shoes that were falling apart. They spiked their water with rum so they could drink it because they had concerns about the local water being unhealthy. And what happened is about 7 to 9 of the soldiers that died with the French were buried on what is now the campus of St. John's College in Annapolis.
And your society, about 100 years ago, erected a monument to them.
In 1911, we erected a monument to the French soldiers and sailors who were buried there. The estate was called Bladen's Folly. That's where the French encamped of Rochambeau's army. They waited there to board transport ships to Yorktown, Virginia. And Bladen's Folly was a large, square, architectural brick house built by Governor Bladen of Maryland, who started spending so much of the colonial legislature's money that they cut him off. The house remained unfinished when the French were there. The interesting thing is that after the Revolution, St. John's College bought that land, and that is now McDowell Hall, the central historic building on St. John's College campus.
And so what's going to happen tomorrow at the monument to these French allies who died on the march?
Yeah. After a welcoming ceremony at the dock, there'll be a parade up to the monument with the old guard fife and drum of the U.S. Army, a very large contingent of expert drummers and fifers, as well as hereditary societies, reenactors, and members of the ship. The monument ceremony will have about 15 or 20 wreath layers. We will have the mayors of Rochefort, France, where the ship was built, the mayor of La Rochelle, French ambassadors, hereditary society leaders, and many others, French citizens of Rochefort. And so it'll be, that part will be somewhat solemn. We have a Ben Goldman is an actor who plays Lafayette very well, and he's going to give a little speech about how much it meant to him as Lafayette, impersonating him, to be there and remember these, you know, fallen soldiers who are buried there.
On WIPR, I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Peter Schwab, past president of the Maryland chapter of the Society of the Sons of the Revolution. We're talking about ceremonies tomorrow in Annapolis when the replica of the French tall ship Hermione comes to call. I have been transfixed looking at images of this replica on the web, this ship Hermione. She's so beautiful. The original French battleship was grounded and wrecked just a few years after she carried Lafayette to America. So how does it come that there is a new frigate Hermione sailing the seas in 2015?
The people of France, especially in Rochefort, spent about over a decade rebuilding this ship. Some of the things they did is they trained people for years to learn the art, shipbuilder's art, how to swing an adze, how to make keels, how to make every aspect of the ship, iron parts, steel. And so they reconstructed a ship. They also had to teach people how to be 18th century artisans and carpenters. And they were able to do this because the sister ship, the Hermione, was La Concordia. That ship was captured by the British. And the British were so impressed with her design that they had draftsmen draw every aspect of her. And those drawings remain in British Museum in perfect condition. That is what was used to build this ship.
Lafayette, according to the website of the Hermione, she has a website, said when he sailed on her in 1780, she sails like a bird. what are some of the other events planned for tomorrow?
Well, there's going to be a reception. It's a private reception, but it's a way of thanking everybody involved in these events, including the city of Annapolis. Bob Agee has been a big help to us in the city of Annapolis. Also, our current president of the Sons of the Revolution is Russell Rich, who's put a lot of work into this. And also, Hall Worthington, a former brigadier general, is the wreath laying ceremony has been his event for many years, and he has connections. So we're having that reception afterwards, and there's many other things going on in Annapolis, though.
What do you hope the public takes away from all this hoopla surrounding the visit of the Hermione?
I think what's relevant is we're living in Maryland and we're looking at current day events and seeing things happen around the world, but there were major world events taking place here in our state, and there were big things going on. There were modern, sophisticated European armies moving in large scale across our countryside. And things happened here that if you go to Annapolis and realize these things happened here, the next time you go, you may feel differently about Annapolis. And that, I think, is what's important for people from Maryland.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Peter Schwab is a member of the Society of the Cincinnati, descendants of Revolutionary Army officers, and he's past president of the Society of the Sons of the Revolution in the state of Maryland. The current president, Russell Rich, has also been working to welcome the Hermione. The Hermione will be in Annapolis through tomorrow and then comes to Baltimore for the weekend, where she'll anchor adjacent to the USS Constellation and the Pride of Baltimore. At our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, we've got more information about the Hermione, her voyage up the East Coast, when you can visit her, and many public events planned in Baltimore Harbor this weekend. I'm Sheila Cass. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in history, 1851, a Baltimore dairyman, Jacob Bussell, opened the country's first ice cream factory. It's been a good week for ice cream. We're back Wednesday. Please join us.